Welcome to Public Health Out Loud, Public Health for the Public. Hi, I'm Dr. Jim McDonald, Medical Director of the Rhode Island Department of Health, and I'm here with Dr. Phil Chan. Dr. Chan, how are you today?
I'm doing well. I want to wish Dr. McDonald a happy birthday. It's your birthday today. Happy birthday,
yeah,
Dr. McDonald.
We're recording this on my birthday, of all things. How about that? You know, it's great to be alive. It's super. And you know, it's funny. I know the day that people are listening to it isn't necessarily a bright, sunny day in beautiful Rhode Island, but today's one of those days where if you don't like weather like today, you just don't like weather. It was just everything was spring out there. Just beautiful. Another gorgeous day here. So today we have a guest, Dr. Chan. We have Dr. Shoham, who's our guest. So I want to welcome Dr. Shoham. Dr. Shoham, welcome to Public Health Out Loud. Good to have you here today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. I used to live up in Boston. My brother went to Rhode Island School of Design, and my son goes to Clark in Worcester.
So Dr. Shoham, thank you so much for telling us a little bit about yourself. Can you tell a little us about your professional self? You know, where do you work? What's your expertise?
So I'm an infectious disease doctor, and I'm at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine in the Division of Infectious Diseases. And my interest has been in taking care of patients that are immune compromised on the basis of either having a transplantation or having cancer and its therapy. And as part of that, I became interested in invasive fungal infections and invasive respiratory viral infections.
Yeah, thank you for that. It's always a pleasure to meet a fellow ID doc. Welcome again to the podcast here. You know, it's funny, as I've sort of thought about it, my life is sort of at this point in time divided into what did I do pre-pandemic to now. Pre-pandemic, I've been involved in a lot of HIV STI work, etc. So thank you for sharing. What have you been doing since the pandemic has been here? Have you been involved in the pandemic response?
Very involved, as everybody in infectious disease and medicine has been. And actually the transition from pre-pandemic to pandemic happened in sort of an organic way, because as somebody that takes care of transplant patients, respiratory viral infections are things that we think about all the time. And initially, when there were the reports that COVID is, there are cases in California or in Seattle, I was very concerned, because I figured that my patients were going to be the ones that were going to be first impacted. It actually didn't turn out that way, but typically transplant patients, if there's a flu case, it's going to be a transplant or a cancer patient is one of the earliest ones. So I thought that would be the situation. And I became desperate to try to find approaches to make their infections less severe if they were to come down with it. One of the things that happened that's very interesting is, for example, lung transplant patients, we've had very few COVID cases. And that's because they're so well trained about avoiding respiratory viruses.
Oh, that's very interesting. You know, it's interesting to talk about patients being well trained to prevent respiratory viruses. I think you just hit on one of the key issues of why the pandemic's been so hard for human beings, period, is most of us aren't just trained to prevent infections. Some of us in healthcare are very good at it, but other patients have really learned that skill. But it leads me towards some treatment options for patients. And convalescent plasma is something that's been in and out of the news. And I thought we'd just start talking a little bit about convalescent plasma today, which is really the subject of our episode today. Can we start, Dr. Shoham, with this? Basically, what is convalescent plasma?
Convalescent plasma is a form of immune-based therapy, and you can think of immune-based therapy as two major groups. There's active immunization and passive immunization. So active immunization is the most famous, and that's when you go and you get a shot, and then your immune system reacts and develops a protective response, whether it's antibody or T cells or combinations of both. Passive immunization is what you do when either you don't have time for a vaccine to kick in, or when there isn't a vaccine for a disease. Probably the most common source of passive immunization that we see is, or we think about, is somebody gets bitten by a dog that could be rabid. They go to the emergency room, and then they get a shot of hyperimmune globulin, somebody's preformed antibodies against rabies from they've had good responses to the vaccine, and then you give it to give them protection immediately, and then you follow that up with a chaser of the shots so that their body can provide protection. So this is a a concept of passive immunotherapy that is used for a variety of different infections. And before the era of antibiotics, people were making what's called serum, and plasma is essentially serum plus clotting factors. So it's serum therapy or plasma therapy is sort of the same thing. And in diseases that don't have a treatment, the idea of doing convalescent plasma, people that recovered from what have you, whether it was MERS, the Middle Eastern respiratory virus, or the first SARS, or Ebola, harvesting their plasma and then turning it around and giving it to them was something that people were thinking about then, in some cases, actually doing. And particularly for MERS and for first SARS. But it had been sort of haphazard because these diseases came and there was a lot of panic and stress and disorganization and people looking for something to do. So they didn't really set it up as the kind of experiments that we really like, the randomized control trials. When COVID was coming, we had a little bit of a chance to get organized and to say, okay, we can do convalescent plasma, but let's do it as part of a well-designed studies. And that's how we at Hopkins got behind this and then worked with our partners in the federal government and with philanthropies to put together two studies that looked at convalescent plasma to see if it would be effective at preventing infection. That's one study, post-exposure prophylaxis, or at treating infection in the outpatient setting. Now, while this was happening, there was a clamor for something to do. Patients were coming into the hospital and mortality was unbelievable. As you remember, just less than a year ago and no therapies were around. So one of the options was, can we do convalescent plasma as a study in patients and just give it and see what happens, not as part of a randomized trial. And we, both our colleagues at Mayo and at Hopkins, thought that if we were going to do it for an inpatient, the best way to do it would be to do it as a randomized controlled trial. However, there's such clamor for the product that all these different groups around the country were putting in expanded access protocols to give it as sort of an emergency use for one patient or for two patients or for their hospital. And the FDA became overwhelmed. So the FDA reached out to our colleagues at Mayo and said, look, there's going to be this stampede of people wanting this to see if it works. Can you track it for us? Can you find out if it's toxic, if it's working? Because this is sort of like a runaway train. And so they did that. And that created the expanded access program. And I continue to be on the scientific board of that, where we were saying, okay, it's going to be used. Let's see if we can derive some safety data first and foremost, safety data, and then see if there's some efficacy data that can be derived from that. So that's sort of the beginnings of convalescent plasma in April, May, setting up studies in the US, hearing some reports from China and from Italy about studies that were done, as you would imagine, not the highest quality of evidence because it was done under duress and observational type studies, small observational studies. We gave it to 10 patients. This is what happened. We gave it to 30 patients and we had 30 controls. This is what happened. But the controls were contemporaneous controls. They weren't, it wasn't like a randomized control trial. And then we just kept at it in terms of doing the studies. In August, there was enough data that came out of the expanded access program that was run by Mayo that led to a few conclusions. So the most important conclusion after giving it to over 20 to 30,000 patients was that it was as safe as regular plasma. Now, regular plasma, fresh frozen plasma, you don't go into the ICU and you look at somebody with a unit of fresh frozen plasma and you say, oh my God, call the priest, this guy's going to die. No, it's not such a dangerous substance. So a lot of people are very comfortable with that. So having data showing that convalescent plasma is essentially as safe as regular plasma was good information. So that came out of that. The other thing that came out is that while this study that the Mayo did with the FDA was really, they're this expanded access program. They were really thinking maybe 5,000 patients, again, get some good safety signals, and that would kind of give you a sense. The demand was so high that every day there would be like another 100 patients, and the next day 200, 1,000 patients. So by the time they turned around in August, over 80, 90,000 patients were already getting it all over the country as part of this emergency expanded access protocol. So then the FDA looked at the data very, very carefully. And the people in CBER, Center for Biological Evaluation Research, these are not cowboys, you know, they're very cautious. And they looked at the data and they said, it looks like if you get it early enough and you give it with enough octane, that this thing makes a difference. And then they had an option. They had three options, essentially. They could say, okay, we're going to keep doing this under the expanded access protocol, which involved data collection and research coordinators and consents and essentially doing it like a study. Mm-hmm. Or we can give an emergency use authorization, which says that we can allow people for it to be used based on the information that we have, sort of the lowest level of non-approval that there is. Or we can outlaw it and say the only way you can give it is as part of a clinical trial. If you give it outside of a clinical trial, then essentially you're not mm-hmm. You're not doing it the right way. And yep. I think they made the right decision in that they looked at this and they said, okay, we have enough data doing a bigger study. I mean, we've already had tens of thousands of patients. So if you can't tell the difference when you have tens of thousands of patients, you're not going to tell the difference when you have double that. So they went to the emergency use authorization. Unfortunately, it got wrapped up in politics, and that created tension that I have never seen in medicine. If you ask me, what is the most shocking thing about COVID that could happen? For me, it would be, oh, that if you are a supporter of one party, you'd be for chloroquine. And if you're a supporter of another party, you'd be against it. I said, oh my God, chloroquine, how could that be a political issue? But there it was. And all of a sudden, plasma became a political issue, which was really disturbing for physician scientists like me who think that the data is data.
Thank you for that history there, Dr. Shoham. You know, it reminds me, and Dr. McDonald, I hope you don't mind, I'm going to steal one of your quotes, but I want to totally attribute it to you. I mean, one term that we've used up here in Rhode Island is instant immunity. And I think, you know, I love that term, Dr. McDonald, that kind of, you know, it kind of encaptures what convalescent plasma is, right? Because as you mentioned, Dr. Shoham, it's preformed antibodies from folks that have had this before. And you sort of broke it down nicely into preventative treatment, like giving it to people who have never had COVID to try to prevent infection. And then for treatment, which is where we've landed. So obviously people who have had COVID-19, which is great. Dr. McDonald, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, it's interesting, you know, more of this like instant immune system. I think that's a concept that resonates with people. And I guess what I'm just curious about, Dr. Shoham, is, you know, maybe just briefly could tell us, have you seen results with this at Johns Hopkins? What kind of data are you seeing with your patients down there?
So our clinical trials are ongoing, and I'm blinded to the results. I'll say that that the clinical trial that is for early infection has gone to the Data Safety Monitoring Board, and they said keep going, which means that what we were doing wasn't futile. Doesn't mean that it's going to ultimately work better than plasma that has no antibodies. The study is plasma that is convalescent plasma versus plasma that is just regular plasma. So it doesn't mean it's going to necessarily work better, but it means that the data so far is not futile. So that's encouraging. And then for the post-exposure prophylaxis, the data is has not been analyzed yet. I'll say a couple things that are issues. One is enrollment in the post-exposure prophylaxis has not been as robust as in the early infection. And I think that is because people that have the infection, they're looking for something. And if they are not eligible for monoclonal antibodies, then many are willing to be part of a trial in order to have a chance of getting something that might be helpful, and then also to try to advance knowledge. If you've had an exposure, then some people do have that motivation. However, there's also the activation energy, if you will, after an exposure to go and get an infusion of a blood product is a little bit harder. So we've had planned statistical analysis that if we had 500 subjects, we would really be able to tell the difference whether one works or not. So far, we're close to 200 subjects, and that's probably as far as we're going to get. We're probably not going to get to 500. And the reason I say that is because we put vaccination as an exclusion for participation in the post-exposure prophylaxis, because the chance of going on to developing an infection is probably a lot lower if you've had a vaccination. So we put that. And then there's just fewer cases, thankfully, right now. Maybe there'll be a third wave, hopefully not, but right now the cases are down. So enrollment is at a trickle. Keeping a study open is expensive. Our funders are asking, when are we going to get the results? So we might not be able to take that study to the conclusion of all the patients that we wanted. That having been said, if the effect size is strong, then we might be able to see a statistically significant difference. So that's still possible. But it may be that even with all the efforts, that the study might not be powered enough to show a difference. And that's just the reality of doing clinical trials. The early treatment study is going very well. And I think we are going to get a definitive answer.
Yeah, thank you for sharing. Let me ask you this, Dr. Shoham. Where we are now, you know, there's been some recent data about convalescent plasma. And of course, I think, as you alluded to, concern about the variants, you know, there's been a couple studies, you know, there's a meta-analysis in the premier journal JAMA looking at, you know, that pooled analyses from all these different studies and didn't find an effect actually by convalescent plasma. And there's been some, you know, the FDA has looked at this and, you know, edited their emergency use authorization. What are your thoughts on at the current time, how we should be using convalescent plasma? Do you still see it as a reasonable option in a certain subset of patients? And how do you think about all the variants and how this plays in?
I think some of the words you're using are exactly perfect. So I think it's all about the subsets of patients. I think early on, when we didn't understand the disease very well, we were asking questions that maybe weren't as smart sort of questions, almost like, does chemotherapy cure cancer? It's like, well, that depends on what chemotherapy, depends on what cancer. So if you look at an unselected group of patients that are inpatients and you give them convalescent plasma versus a control, it's very likely that there's going to be a subgroup in there, if you will, a Goldilocks effect, where there's going to be a group that it doesn't matter what you give them, they're going to get better. And there's going to be another group that it doesn't matter what you give them, they're not going to get better, particularly if it's a product that doesn't work at that stage of the disease. And there's going to be nestled in there the sweet spot. And typically when we do clinical trials, we know a lot about the natural history of the disease, but we don't know that much about the drug we're testing, which is why we're doing it here. We, in our desperation, rushed in to do studies on a disease we didn't understand very well with a drug we didn't understand very well. So when you do that, I think it could be expected that the early clinical trials are going to show subgroups that have a suggestion of efficacy, but the study wasn't powered to show that. So I think that's some of the reason that there was a study that came out of India, for example, that many of the patients were getting it later in the course of disease, and many of the plasma products that they were receiving didn't have very high levels of antibody. So it's sort of like the perfect storm of you lose patients in the study that got low octane stuff, and then you lose patients in the study that got it at a point where it wouldn't make a difference, and then you're left with this relatively small subset, and then the results aren't statistically significant because you weren't powered to show that. So I think that's been a problem with the clinical trials, and that's why in some ways doing a case control study when you're really homing in on a certain group of patients, it can be very helpful to say, okay, something's going on here. The randomized trial, which I look at as sort of a Formula One car, the best of the best, but everything has to be set up just right, the right question, the right product, the right testing to come up with the result. And then everything isn't lined up perfectly, then you don't get the result. When you do get the result, it's spectacular. You really, but but there's a lot of places to make a mistake. I think what has been problematic in COVID in general is that we're so hungry for information. So you get a press release that say such and such drug didn't work, but then nobody's had the time to really plow in through the subgroups to find out where it might have worked, and then set up the next set of experiments where you focus. I'm not a cardiologist, but I would think, like, if you did early studies on cardiac catheterization, you might not see an impact on heart disease. But then as you learn more and more, and you say, okay, door to balloon time or different things, you can say, okay, this is the group where it's going to make a difference. But, you know, we're doing all this science so quickly, but we also need to remember that by doing it so quickly, these are processes that normally take, I don't know, 10, 15 years from molecule to market, and we're compressed it all into 1 year.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Shoham. I think you gave us a wonderful overview of convalescent plasma. And as I close out our episode today, you know, one of the things I'm just thoughtful about is, you know, it's been a little over a year in Rhode Island in particular since patient number one to where we are now. And I'm very thankful for where we are in many ways. Who would have me imagined we would have had three really effective vaccines at this point, and, you know, monoclonal antibodies for treatment. And, you know, it's fun to see convalescent plasma still in the mix as, you know, a therapeutic option. And I think, like you said so well, is that, you know, science does take time. And it's funny how so much of this has been done in the microwave. And not saying it needs to be in the crock pot, but boy, it does need to go in the conventional oven sometimes and let us get the science to come out right. It's been fun to chat with Dr. Shoham from Johns Hopkins, infectious disease expert. We've loved this review of convalescent plasma. Dr. Chan, as we get to our end here, what's the final word for today?
Great. I just want to thank Dr. Shoham again. Thank you for all those insights about convalescent plasma. Wish you certainly the best of luck through the rest of the pandemic. Hopefully it's ending soon. But in closing, for our listeners, I leave you with a moment of Zen to consider throughout the rest of your day. And here it is, a quote from the Buddha. No matter how hard the past, you can always begin again. Food for thought. Thank you all and be well.
Thank you. This was Public Health Out Loud, Public Health for the Public. I'm Dr. Jim McDonald, Medical Director of the Rhode Island Department of Health. I want to thank Carol Stone, our Technical Director, and Jose Garcia, our Executive Producer. Have a good and keep up the great, Rhode Island.